The way I see it, I was still a student and I was still a trainee. Somebody should have looked at me and said, hey, you need to take care of yourself. And that never happened.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Oden. This is Memoirs in Medicine, a podcast featuring the personal stories of healthcare professionals.
And I'm Dr. David Spiro. On each episode, one healthcare worker will share a moment from their career that has profoundly affected them and provide one suggestion, no matter how big or small, for improving the practice of medicine.
Through storytelling, we hope to highlight the humanity in healthcare and create a space for candid and respectful discussion.
To protect patient privacy, some details may have been changed, but the stories are real. Welcome to Memoirs in Medicine.
Welcome, everybody, to the inaugural episode. I am John Oden. With me is my partner in crime.
Yes, this is David Spiro, and it's great to have our initial inaugural episode. I'm a pediatric emergency medicine physician, and we're partnering together. Can you imagine a pediatric ER physician and a pediatric endocrinologist hanging out to talk about this? But we're going to do it. And I'm really excited to hear about your story today as part of our initial inaugural episode.
Yeah, I'm excited to share it. I think it's an important topic to touch on. And just a little bit of personal background. My daughter's about to enter medical school and will eventually be a pediatric resident or a resident, whatever she decides to do. She's not quite decided yet. But I think it's good for her and her colleagues in medical school to kind of understand the barriers that they're going to face. The one thing that we're going to be discussing kind of specifically today is discrimination within that residency training program that I experienced. And I don't think it is any one individual's fault that I faced discrimination, but I did, or at least I felt I did.
Yeah. And I would say that discrimination is a big word. And I know that we experienced, you were talking about something that happened, what, 15 years ago for you? 20 years ago?
20 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. But we want to recognize that discrimination is actually happening today. It happens every day at work, and there are all forms of discrimination.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to hear about your story.
Well, thank you. And so let me take a step backwards and kind of define what kind of discrimination I'm talking about. I'm a middle-aged Caucasian male, so you wouldn't expect a middle-aged Caucasian male to be concerned about discrimination. And it certainly wasn't overt discrimination or violent discrimination. I have a chronic disease called type 1 diabetes. And back in the middle to late 1990s, although diabetes was well-treated and well-controlled and understood, especially in medical circles, there was this lack of understanding of how to fold an individual with a chronic disease, much less type 1 diabetes, into the kind of boiling pot of training to be a provider in medicine.
And when were you actually diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
Oh, that was 1981, September of 1981.
And how old were you?
I was 10. I was 10 years old. I remember the days very well. I mean, the training and the medications that we used back in 1981, the technology that was back then is so rudimentary. And actually, you know, we kind of laugh about it now, but back then, as it is now, is life-saving stuff.
And how were you diagnosed? How did that actually happen when you were 10?
I had a classic presentation. So I presented with significant weight loss, fatigue, and what doctors term polyuria and polydipsia, or just drinking and urinating constantly. Mm. There is a picture that has since been lost in my family of myself and my sister in a park in Dallas. It's one of those dinosaur fossil parks. You know, you walk through, it's kind of very primitive. And we see in the picture my sister, who is just about a year older than I am at the time. So she's about 11, I'm 10. And she has to hold on to my pants to keep me from falling down because I can't stand up very well. Hmm. And I'm just skin and bones. I'm not a heavy person, but I was not supposed to be that thin. And it's kind of obvious there that I had lost a lot of weight and was not feeling myself. So shortly after that picture was taken, my parents took me to the doctor and ended up being treated at UTMB in Galveston.
Right. And now you're a pediatric endocrinologist, which is incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that part of your journey of becoming a physician that manages children with diabetes began that day that you were diagnosed. Is that true or not true?
It is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely true. And a question that a lot of my patients will ask me quite commonly is that how did you get into medicine? Is it because you have diabetes? Because I share the fact that I have diabetes with all my families. I'm actually quite proud of the idea of a person of my age that has lived for 40 years with a chronic disease and has done quite well. I like to use myself as a role model for kids that are now being diagnosed in the hospital and telling them that, you know, whatever they want to do, they can absolutely do. In fact, really the only thing that a person with type 1 diabetes is barred from doing based on safety is active service in the military, which I have a little bit against. I think a person with diabetes could serve active service in military in some way, shape, and form. But of course, the idea is that, you know, if they were on the front lines and they needed insulin right away, that there's sometimes you just couldn't get it, and that would be a unfortunate happenstance. But I think there are some jobs in the military that a person who wants to serve their country should be able to do it. But anyway, that's a different form of discrimination that we can get into later on.
Yeah, and I want to get into discrimination, but before I do, and I know this was not the initial thought process around this podcast, but how did you and your family react to the diagnosis when you first found out? What was that like?
My recollection is my mom was very protective of me. She didn't leave my side. She didn't let the doctors leave the room without her asking about 50 questions. I think my dad was in somewhat of a little bit of denial. He tried to make light of it a little bit and try to make me feel better, which many fathers will do. Myself, I kind of took control of the whole situation. And this is a fun fact. I never let a nurse give me a shot, not once. So the first day when I was diagnosed and I came into that room and they came at me with that needle and syringe with insulin in it, I asked the nurse very kindly if I could please do it. And she said yes. And she showed me how to do it and, you know, kind of phantom showed me how to do it. And then I did it myself. And from then on, I've been doing it myself. I think the only other person that's actually given me an injection is my wife.
And do you share with your patients now as a pediatric endocrinologist that takes care of this? Do you share the fact that you have diabetes with your patients?
Yeah, all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't like hiding that information from them. They are pretty quick people, as most of our patients are, and they see that I have an insulin pump hanging off my belt, and they can identify that, and they'll ask. And I've asked the nurses to freely share that information just to make sure that, again, I'd like to think of myself as a role model, as doctors should think of themselves as role models. And I answer questions as honestly as I can with these families, telling them about hypoglycemic events, high blood sugars that happen all the time, the barriers that we face, but also the successes and the fact that these kiddos can be as successful in life as they want to be. They can do anything they want to do. They can be a doctor. They can be a nurse.
Yeah.
They can be a lawyer.
The only reason why I ask is that this is oftentimes not discussed in medical school in terms of what are you allowed to or not allowed to share from your personal life?
Oh, yeah.
When you're with patients and, you know, we in the pediatric ER, sometimes I have children that die that are the age of my child at that time. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes after a code, I can become incredibly traumatized or saddened or have an emotional influx of feelings.
Of course.
And it's related to something around my own personal life. And it's always something that I struggle with, how much I share about my own personal life. And it's really awesome that you feel comfortable doing that.
You know, that's going to be a very interesting story, David, that what you just brought up there. And I think us being open enough with our patients and honest with our patients is a critical thing for us to kind of impart kind of one of the more important messages in clinic time. It's not always how we mess with their medications or look at lab work or do an exam. It's actually how we connect with them. And I think that's a critical piece in our history.
Well, I want to hear about what happened during your training around discrimination. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so there are two particular events that kind of popped up in my mind over the Christmas break. So there was every Christmas, I think we kind of send out a Facebook chat, if you will, with the families that follow us in Facebook. And we like to give kind of impart some happy stories, sad stories, diabetes stories. And I sat there thinking for, you know, 10, 15 minutes, I just don't have a story this year. I don't know what to tell them. Nothing really interesting happened to me this year. And then I thought, wait a minute, if we're really going to be honest with our kids and our families, we need to start thinking kind of deeply. And so these two events popped into my mind. And the first one I'll share with you was after a particularly busy night of call. So every night of call is grueling, especially for a trainee. They don't know exactly what they're doing, and they have to communicate often with their attending physician who is proctoring them and making sure they're doing the right thing. But we had a lot of kids that were sick, and we had to go to the emergency room, God bless y'all, David, to pick these kids up and admit them to the hospital and begin the appropriate therapy on them. And as time does, time gets away from you. And at that time, I was on insulin shots. I was giving myself 3 injections per day, 1 at breakfast, 1 at lunch, and 1 at dinner time. And rounds that morning went a little bit long. And I did not take the time to stop myself and say, hey, I need to take my medication, because that wasn't our culture. The culture in medicine is quite, at least back in the 90s, I'm sure it is very similar today. It's kind of cutthroat. It's very what we used to call gunner mentality. You get in the front of the line and you're the smartest guy there and you're the fastest guy there. And you don't have time to stop and smell the roses, if you will. And so at that point in time, that was my mentality. And I thought to myself, I know my blood sugar is going up because I haven't had my insulin yet. I haven't eaten yet. I'm not feeling very good, but I let time pass. But the way I see it, I was still a student and I was still a trainee, and I probably should have been, somebody should have looked at me and said, hey, John, you need to take care of yourself. And that never happened.
And folks you worked with knew you had type 1 diabetes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody knew.
And they knew because you, other than saying it, you were bringing needles to work and your equipment. Did you have a box at the time, or like what you carry something with you? And
in the call room, so call room is a place that we all kind of sleep when we can. The call room had my my overnight bag, and within my overnight bag, it had my equipment, blood sugar meter, and insulin and such. Mm-hmm. My colleagues, I'm not exactly sure I would say they should have stopped me and nudged me and said, hey, aren't you supposed to be doing this and that? I don't think that's really true. I think that's kind of a hard thing to say about colleagues that are also going through the training process that we go through. But, the attending physician probably should have recognized it. And the guy that I was working with, that guy's top notch. I mean, he's a top notch infectious disease attending, brilliant man. He just didn't notice it. And my purpose in telling this story is not to put my finger on him and say, hey, you should have done better, but maybe say to the global community of doctors to say, if you have a person that has, any kind of disability, and I hate to call type 1 diabetes a disability, but in this case, it is kind of, because you have to treat yourself a little bit differently than everybody else, and it does slow you down a little bit. I think if you have anybody with a disability, that those disabilities need to be understood, and you have to have the ability to discreetly, not overtly, but discreetly discuss that with the trainee that needs to have some help. So as rounds go on, and I'm, kind of continuing the story just to kind of paint a little bit of a clearer picture. As rounds go on, they take an hour or two. We stop by each room and talk about each patient. We go in and examine. And I'm presenting all the kids that were admitted, and there were quite a few that night. So I'm presenting quite a few kids, and I have to keep a lot of stuff in my mind. One of the reasons why I was probably absent-minded in my care is I was taking care of a whole other group of kids. And by 11 o'clock, 11:30, when rounds were done, we started probably around 7:30 or 8. My legs were real crampy. Having high blood sugars for me is kind of like, you get kind of a fullness to your stomach, kind of like you've eaten or had too much to drink, not alcohol, but just too much volume, too much fluid. Mm-hmm. And then my muscles feel like they're soaked in oil. I mean, literally heavy and hard to move and achy. And so that's the way I was feeling. And I remember being crouched up against a wall as they were finishing rounds, just crouched on the floor, just not being able to stand very well. And at that time, I just knew I had to just get up and go take care of what needed to be taken care of. And I only vaguely remember seeing the attending at the time. Again, a great guy, but I think he was more in tune to his patients than he was to me. And he didn't stop me. He didn't ask me, hey, you've got more work to do. You need to finish this up. He just never encouraged me to do that. So yeah, I kind of felt that when I was thinking about that probably is a little bit discriminatory. It was absent-minded, and they didn't quite see the needs of the individuals that they were taking care of and they were training. So I thought that was a good story to bring up. and start discussing in the context of, hey, we probably need to be as attendings, as you and I are attendings now, that we need to have the best interests of our trainees at heart at all times.
Yeah, so let's just take a quick step back. So again, you were a medical student when this happened, correct?
I was a resident.
And what year resident were you?
Oh, I don't remember. Second, maybe first or second year.
So second year resident. And when you're a resident, you knew that you wanted to do fellowship training. So
yep.
There's a certain pressure to perform well.
Yeah.
On rotations, right? So you are given good letters of recommendation to get to that next level of training.
Right.
So there are these pressures that we have in medicine that I don't know if the general public is aware of, in terms of when you're a medical student, you have to do certain things to become a resident. When you're a resident,
right,
you need to do certain things. And there are certain unwritten codes that are there. And the one of the unwritten codes that at least feels that it's the same today as it was 20 or 30 years ago, is you don't complain about things. You don't want to be labeled as a complainer.
Staying below the radar, yeah.
Yeah, and so at that point, do you feel like you didn't want to make a big deal that you were not feeling well and you wanted to finish the rounds with this particular infectious disease attending?
Oh, of course.
Uh-huh. There's that pressure.
There is always pressure, always pressure. I mean, I don't think that pressure ever leaves us, David. I think, you know, you go from the medical school pressure of studying and making good grades to residency pressure to see a large volume of patients and a vast array of different diagnoses and pathologies and, you know, be right on the button when you're diagnosing and treating your patients, to that even going on and being either a private physician who needs to take care of kids and hold their own metrics of quality. And then an academician like you, yourself and myself, who kind of prides themselves on not only that quality of medical care, but also quality in education and bringing up medical students and residents in the correct way and making sure that they're trained in the correct way. And that's a whole different kind of pressure. But in this kind of pressure, in the residency kind of pressure, when somebody is needing to take care of themselves in a little bit of a different way, I think we have to have it as a team approach to make sure that these people are taking care of themselves correctly and that they're healthy enough to continue through whatever is going on, which includes rounds.
Right. So I think this happens all the time. And I don't mean to trivialize your type one, but we as physicians, we get sick. And the last 2 years, many of us have had COVID one or more times. We get ill, family members become ill, and then we have a dilemma. We have this personal dilemma of how much do we share? Do we work sick?
Right.
How sick do you need to be to not work? I don't know the answers to these questions, but this is a huge topic. And I don't know if we really talk about it. I've never seen a rule book of, okay, these are the five things. If you have these things, for sure you shouldn't work. And these five things maybe, and these five things, if you have it, you just need to suck it up. I haven't seen that list.
I haven't. And I think for any disability, I think any disability, we should make allowances to allow that disability to do what they want to do, to be a part of whatever community they want to be a part of. And medicine is not one in which we should limit access. But yeah, you are absolutely right. This is a huge topic. And in fact, I think recently, when we're talking about illness and COVID, there are some companies that would prefer if people don't announce their illness and suck it up or man up. I think man up was the vernacular in that culture from some of these private fund companies that are propping up around the country. I guess my point, I think, you know, my main point again, I think is the fact that when we are faced with an unusual situation and an individual that needs a different kind of care, not necessarily complex care, we just have to keep our eyes open. And if we do not keep our eyes open, if we don't keep our minds open and make sure that your charges, your students, your residents, your fellows are not taking care of themselves, you need to step in and tell them it is okay, because we are brought up in a culture of, again, that kind of gunner culture. I don't know if you guys ever use the word gunner. We use gunner all the time. The gunners were the guys in the front, or the guys or girls, excuse me, in the front seat, in the front row, always taking notes, making 100+ on their exams, you know, going to Harvard and Yale, those are the guys that they're guys that stand out, right? And this gunner culture needs to be clarified in such a way that people should understand that it's okay to take a knee for a second and take care of yourself.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is your chronic condition, and thank you for sharing all of this today, because
my pleasure.
I think it's important. It is obvious. You have equipment. You had mentioned earlier. You have your pump that's visible to your patients.
Right.
How about residents and trainees who have mental health problems?
That may
not be so obvious, right?
Correct.
And the only reason why I bring it up, it's funny. I'm having a flashback because one of my co-residents, where I trained in Colorado, clearly had depression.
Mm.
She had major depression heading into training. And the way we handled it at the time, and I say we, me being a co-resident faculty, was barbaric and cruel and lots of whispers and she's just not making it. And I guess the pearl I'm trying to take out of this, we not only need to take care of ourselves, but we all need to be taking care of each other.
Right.
And when I mean all, I mean at all different levels of the matrix, right? Attendings need to be watching out for the trainees. Trainees need to be watching out for attendings. Trainees need to be supporting themselves with whatever kind of issue that comes up. And what I think really needs to happen, John, is we need to get to a point in medicine where we feel comfortable being open and honest about medical issues or medical and or psychiatric or behavioral health issues that we all have, because we're freaking human beings.
Yeah.
We're not God.
Right.
We're human beings and we suffer from all of these things. And we need to take it from taboo to I'm here to support you and how can I best support you?
I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. I think you're absolutely right about all of that. Because I can guarantee you there are people, our colleagues, medical students, residents, nursing staff, people in the community, who would have a very hard time communicating that they have, for example, your example, depression, anxiety.
Hmm.
Anxiety that can be so debilitating that they have a hard time coming to work and they do not enjoy work.
Yeah.
How do you address that? Well, in my mind, you have to kind of break down the cultural barriers of thinking that there is going to be some sort of punitive action taken against them.
Mm.
That there aren't laws, the American Disabilities Act, for example, that protect them. And there are. And I think having a dialogue with senior leadership to say, you know, we need better mental health coverage. We need better wellness coverage for us. And that doesn't just mean I have an insurance, which I do, and everybody who's a faculty member does. But wellness in the fact that we take a second for ourselves each day. We exercise, we eat right, we drain stress through whatever method that is a healthy way of doing it, like yoga or Pilates or taking a run, reading a book, something like that. I think that's kind of a first step.
Yeah. You know, it's funny reflecting on your story. My mother just had a small stroke. And I was about to start a shift and I had to leave urgently and miss a shift or two to fly to a different city to be with her and my family. And reflecting on your story, you know, and this topic we're bringing up, I felt bad. Like I felt guilty that I was leaving work.
Oh, yeah.
And I was having my colleagues work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of our culture, and I don't know how to change it. But in other fields and specialties, I'm sure legal profession, et cetera, I think that this kind of thing exists, but I don't know if it's the same.
I agree. I have the same problem. You know, if you wake up and your stomach hurts and you don't want to expose kids to whatever illness you have, you think to yourself, should I go to work? Should I really go to work with 103 fever and stomach? Probably not, but I'm going to anyway, or at least before COVID hit, we would.
Yeah.
So the second story is a little bit more on the nose as far as discrimination. I don't think the individual that was doing it meant it to be discriminatory, but he thought it was funny. So it happened quite often. And as David said before, I was resident, I knew I wanted to be a pediatric endocrinologist. And as such, I always kind of hung around the endocrine group. And I was always the guy who admitted the kids with diabetes and all sorts of endocrine problems. There's just right always there in the front line. And as such, I had questions, as residents do, as students do, as trainees do. And there were times my questions were probably considered quite ignorant. And if I were to look back on myself and listen to myself ask those questions with my level of expertise now, I probably would think that they're a little ignorant. But
In my world, there are no stupid questions.
No, yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't mean to say that they're stupid questions, but the questions were quite basic.
Okay.
I think if we were thinking, they would be basic questions.
Okay.
And no, you should never think of anybody. I mean, we get questions from primary care providers all the time about, you know, basic labs, and we are happy to answer those questions because we feel very confident in them. Now, in this case, these questions were viewed upon this particular attending who was a pediatric endocrinologist and kind of my mentor, if you will. He would always look at me and say, when he didn't think my question was very good, he would look at me and say, "Well, John, what is your blood sugar?" Kind of insinuating that my blood sugar was low or high, and that's why I was asking such a silly question.
Not okay. Not okay.
That's why I didn't know the answer. It's not okay. That's not okay, right?
Not okay.
That's not okay. I think that would be kind of, I mean, I can't even think of another example with a different chronic disease, you know. How do you feel that that's right? Now, the question, I mean, I always felt that that was wrong, and my wife always felt that that was wrong, but that's just this guy's way, and everybody thought it was funny around me. Mm. And so there'd be some chuckles and laughter, and I'd always just kind of, you know, put my head down and just go, well, I guess it could be low. I haven't checked it in a while. But anyway, mm-hmm. That's the way my days went. And, you know, you had this conversation. He would answer it kind of with a flippant tone to him and then move on. But my question is, you know, do you think in the context of a group setting, when you're in a group and you're doing, you know, you have all kinds of different trainees, you have other attendings around you, you have medical students around you, and then you kind of belittle particularly an individual with diabetes for potentially having a low blood sugar. How does that translate into that individual's character in view of other people? Like, how do other people view that person's character and capabilities?
Well, I think that there's a couple things to unpack there. One is when you are discriminated against, or you feel like you're discriminated against, or there was a comment that was made to you from someone who I would call is in a position of power. So you're a resident, you want to become a fellow. This person's a pediatric endocrinologist. You want to do a fellowship in pediatric endocrinology. This person may need to be writing a letter for you, and he's a mentor. And he says something repeatedly that's not okay. Mm-hmm. Is there a place and a space for you to be able to approach that person and say, hey, this is not okay. This doesn't make me feel good. And yet this is a person that's going to be writing one of three letters for you to get to that next level of training.
Mm-hmm. Which will undoubtedly change that letter.
It may change that letter. And so, again, in the medical world, probably similar to the world of the military, there are pecking orders. You're a medical student, you're a resident, you're a fellow, you're a junior attending, you're a senior attending. In my humble opinion, the most efficient organizations and ones that work well, let's not just say from a throughput standpoint, but from a cultural standpoint, the matrix is flat.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone can come up to anyone else in the organization and say whatever they need to say and feel okay about it. So in my world, when I'm with trainees, especially the fellows that I work with closely, I'll often say to them, if I ever say anything that offends you or that is upsetting to you, I want you to tell me, because sometimes we all put our foot in our mouths. I mean, we're all going to say something at some point that's not okay. And so we, as leaders in medicine, we need to be comfortable disseminating the idea that it is okay to talk about something that makes you feel uncomfortable.
You're right.
But like I started off at the beginning of this conversation, discrimination exists all the time in all various forms, whether it's gender discrimination or racial discrimination, or in this case, chronic disease discrimination. We need to call it out. We need to be talking about it. And I look forward to further episodes with bringing on guests where we can continue this discussion around discrimination, because it's a huge topic.
Indeed. I agree.
Yeah. So I can't wait to do this podcast series with you, and this is the start. But for those of you that are listening to our inaugural episode, I want everyone to know that Dr. John Oden is one of my heroes.
Oh.
You are a hero to me, and I'm not kidding, because you have been living for the last 30 or 40 years with a chronic illness, and you exercise and you take care of yourself, and you're open and vulnerable with your patients about your disease state. And I am sure, I've never been to endocrine clinic because that scares me. I'm an ER doctor. Clinic scares ER doctors, the word clinic. But what I can tell you is that I am sure that you have inspired hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. You are an inspiration to me. You're a hero to me. And you are, I'm sure, a hero to the children and the families that we serve. And I can't wait to do this podcast series. It's going to be so much freaking fun.
Well, thank you, David. And you know, I think when you give your story at our next podcast, it's going to be just as inspiring.
Audience, listen to us. This is going to be fun. You're going to be hearing some really cool, visceral stories about healthcare providers and how we engage with ourselves and our patients and people we work with. And we're really, really excited to bring this content to the world.
Very excited.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening today, and looking forward to the future of this awesome collaboration with Dr. Oden.
Thank you, Dr. Spiro.
Visit memoirsinmedicine.com to learn more about this program, sign up for our newsletter, or leave us a voicemail. That's memoirsinmedicine.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or in other major podcasting apps, so you can have episodes delivered to you automatically on the day they're released. Till next time.